From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Closing off a week that sported daily revelations of U.S. spying against the governments of its closest allies, Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy said the U.S. ambassador has been summoned over reports that the NSA spied on that country. Rajoy's decision came on Friday after Spanish media reports showed that the NSA had spied on several government officials and politicians, including former Prime Minister Rodriguez Zapatero. Rajoy said he summoned the U.S. ambassador, James Costos, to explain the recent spying reports. Spain is the latest European country to call in the U.S. ambassador, as both Germany and France have summoned their U.S. envoys earlier this week, amid separate reports revealing that the NSA had targeted those two nations. And it appears the NSA has eavesdropped on hundreds of phone numbers belonging to dozens of world leaders, according to newly leaked documents supplied by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Britain's Guardian newspaper reported Thursday that a classified memo provided by Snowden suggests that the NSA encouraged officials within the U.S. government and intelligence community to share among their colleagues contact information pertaining to international heads of state. According to The Guardian, the memo made reference to an unnamed U.S. official who had reportedly supplied the NSA with over 200 numbers, including 35 belonging to world leaders. The memo reads, quote, "These numbers, plus several others, have been tasked," close quote, "or monitored." The leaders themselves are not identified in the memorandum, but classified documents previously disclosed by Snowden have suggested that the NSA spied on conversations involving citizens of France, Germany, and Brazil, among others. As European leaders met today in Brussels, fresh revelations about NSA spying continue to emerge, with an Italian magazine focusing attention on the allegedly vast scale of U.S. and British surveillance of telephone and email communications in Italy. The weekly L'Espresso magazine said it had ascertained that Italy, and particularly Sicily, had become a focus of activity because of its strategic location between Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. According to the magazine, documents obtained by whistleblower Edward Snowden showed the intensive monitoring of Italian telecom networks by both the NSA and GCHQ. It said the GCHQ had access to 3 fiber optic telecommunications cables, CMEW3, CMEW4, and the Europe-Asia segment of the so-called flag cable, which between them had 3 landing points in Sicily. When asked by The Guardian to comment, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney referred them to comments made earlier yesterday during a briefing in which he acknowledged the NSA disclosure and said, quote, "The revelations have clearly caused tension in our relationships with some countries, and we are dealing with that through diplomatic channels," close quote. Meanwhile, in France, the daily newspaper Le Monde published an internal NSA document which it said showed the, quote, "tensions and distrust between Paris and Washington," close quote. The document, a preparatory note before a visit to the NSA by 2 top French intelligence officials in April of this year, showed that French officials suspected the U.S. could have been behind a now well-known cyber attack on the French presidential computer network in May of last year. That hacking incident occurred just before the second round of the French presidential election, when Nicolas Sarkozy was still in power. Le Monde said that the 2 French officials went to ask their U.S. counterparts at NSA for an explanation. The NSA document says that no U.S. intelligence agency or of its close allies in Britain and Canada were behind that attack. But the French government tightened its cybersecurity after the May 2012 incident, in which suspected detectors had been installed, allowing access to information from the presidency and the hacking of presidential computers. According to Le Monde, an expert on the case told them, quote, "The attack was not part of an act of sabotage which was to be made public, but of a desire to be permanently installed invisibly at the center of the presidency," close quote. An alleged FBI investigation of the head of a Russian cultural exchange program in Washington is reportedly underway. Russian diplomat Yuri Zaitsev, who heads the Russian exchange program in the U.S. Capitol, has apparently been flagged by American authorities as a possible recruiter of young Americans as spies, under cover of organizing them for trips to Russia. The accused diplomat said he's perplexed by the claims and that he laments the apparent return of Cold War rhetoric to Washington. A leak about the investigation of Zaitsev has been published by several U.S. media outlets, including the internet version of the Washington Post and the website of the media outlet Mother Jones. According to reports, unnamed sources in the FBI told journalists that Zaitsev and his associates had organized expense-paid visits to Russia for about 130 Americans, mostly nonprofit workers, business people, and political aides. For some visitors, the Russian side absorbed transportation and accommodation charges, though investigators apparently do not know if Zaitsev personally accompanied any of the visitors on their trips to Russia. The FBI apparently believes the senator's executive was preparing files on those visiting Russia and could potentially be paving the way for future recruitment of them in the exchange program. Zaitsev denies this, saying that, apparently, quote, someone has found it necessary to cool Russian-American relations, close quote. Although many observers took note of the call by China to de-Americanize the global economy in the face of last week's congressional brinksmanship over potential default by the U.S., the process of building economic and political structures outside of U.S. control or even influence has been going on for a while. And this past week was a busy one, both in Eurasia and right here in the Western Hemisphere, in the nation south of El Rio Grande. We spoke earlier today with independent journalist Tony Solo, as we usually do on Fridays, about this. He gave us this report from his home in Managua, Nicaragua.
For me, the Ibero-American summit, which is a summit of the Latin American nations and the former colonial powers, which were mainly Spain and Portugal. Portugal, of course, was the colonial power in Brazil.
Right.
And they had this meeting in Panama, and it was in many ways a very strange event, because whereas in previous years Latin American presidents generally did make a serious effort to get there, and they regarded it as a forum where it was possible for the Latin American countries and the former colonial powers, Portugal and Spain, to review mainly their economic relationships, but also the international political scene in general. And that was important in recent years, because the European Union is a major player in terms of the Latin American economy, not just in terms of aid, but also obviously in terms of general commerce and general trade. And so from the point of view of the Latin American countries, Spain and Portugal were very important interlocutors, or intermediaries, if you like, between what for many years were regarded as the developing countries of Latin America and what have been regarded until recently as the developed countries in the European Union. And of course, with the crisis in Europe ever since 2007-2008 and the resurgence of the Latin American economies over the last two or three years, that situation has changed somewhat. And what happened at this summit in Panama was that as many as eight Latin American presidents, including very significantly Dilma Rousseff of Brazil, the continent's biggest economy by far, just didn't bother going.
Right. And also kind of making Portugal sort of irrelevant there too, right?
Well, I think obviously you can overstate the significance of that kind of thing. You know, it's just one summit, and it is symbolically important that almost all the ALBA presidents just didn't bother going. I don't think Argentina went. obviously because Christina Kirchner was unwell. Yeah. And when I say they didn't go, I mean, it's not that they didn't go, they just sent a lower-level delegation.
Right. Yeah, yeah. The countries represented, they just didn't send a head of state. They didn't feel
that's right.
It, you know?
Exactly. So, and that means that, in one sense, that symbolizes the fact that Spain and Portugal need Latin America more than Latin America needs them.
Right. That's right. That's the point.
And so, on one level. And of course, I mean, that doesn't mean that the European Union isn't a very important player in terms of the Latin American economy. Of course it is. And likewise, so is the United States. But it indicates that the world is changing really quickly, almost before our eyes, and from one year to the next. And the importance of the Asian economies, is obviously, especially China, but also South Korea and the ASEAN countries, Indonesia in particular, are becoming more important. And in that regard, another interesting aspect of that Ibero-American summit, from my point of view, was that it showed the inherent weakness of the so-called alliance of the Pacific countries, that are those are Chile, Peru, Colombia, and Mexico, and with Costa Rica tagging along behind because it's not actually a formal member of that group. But those four countries have set up what they call the Alliance for the Pacific, and it's very much a neoliberal market capitalist orientation that they have.
Right.
And it's interesting to see how that's playing out in both in continental terms on this side of the Pacific within Latin America, because they made next to no impact in terms of the overall consensus that was a very banal consensus that came out in the final declaration of the summit. And whereas by contrast, I think it's yesterday and today, the CELAC energy ministers, that CELAC is the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, by contrast with the kind of very much talking shop characteristics of the Ibero-American summit, the CELAC energy ministers meeting in Montego Bay in Jamaica over the last couple of days, they're talking about very concrete things. They're talking about how Latin America and the Caribbean are going to integrate their energy systems to increase energy security in terms of oil supply, electricity generation, that kind of thing. And that's a far more important meeting than what Spain and Portugal had to chat about with Latin America minus eight heads of state, you know?
Well, yeah, also, so, if you look at the role that energy has played, first in development, for example, in Nicaragua, Venezuela's assistance in terms of constructing generators for electricity, but also in terms of development in general, using the revenues that Venezuela, rather than repatriating to the United States, as it did for decades, now uses for development all over Central and South America and the Caribbean.
Yeah, very much so, Don, because Nicaragua's example is probably the most obvious in many ways, because what Venezuela's development corporation, in particular its concessionary oil program, has meant for Nicaragua is that Nicaragua has had between $400 and $500 million extra a year in order to invest in its economy, and that's repayable over 20 years at 2%. Or 50% of the cost of Venezuela's oil is repayable over 20 years at 2% interest.
Yeah.
And what that releases Nicaragua from the fruitless treadmill of traditional aid and debt cooperation relationships that it's had with the European Union, with North America, for example.
Yep, IMF.
Something else, the other aspect of that is, if you look at it and compare what's happening in Latin America with what's happening in Central Asia, is that the for it, and the reason I mention that is because over the last couple of days, or was it on the 24th?
Yeah, the Eurasian Union. Yeah,
the Eurasian Economic Union had its meeting.
That's right.
And what they're talking about is setting up an economic union that is led by Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. And the reason, that might sound crazy, but Kazakhstan is a major energy supplier in Central Asia.
That's right.
And the significance of that in terms of Latin America is that you get people like the South Korean president, who's an extreme right winger. She's no kind of radical at all. But what she's saying is that the creation of the creation of a new Eurasia, she says, is not simply a dream, but a goal that can be reached. Mm-hmm. And a new Eurasia will provide a new influx of investments and jobs and turn Eurasia into a truly united continent. And so what she's talking about is both energy integration in terms of gas and oil pipelines, joining Russia, China, and South Korea, which obviously includes North Korea.
Right, it would have to go through North Korea.
With the countries of Central Asia, as well as Pakistan and India, but also Iran and Afghanistan.
Right.
And they're not just talking about energy links, they're also talking about rail communications. So, you know, and if you compare that with what's happening in Latin America, and then you look at the chaos, the economic chaos that is prevalent in the United States and the European Union, and it's a completely different world. It's a completely new world.
This looks like Hugo Chavez's vision, like taking root all over the planet. Really, this because what they're calling the EEU remarkably looks like ALBA.
Yeah, and that one of the interesting things about the Eurasian Continent Integration Initiative is that all the countries have an equal vote, and that's the same as in ALBA. Right. In ALBA, Dominica or St. Vincent and the Grenadines have the same voting status as Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, or Cuba, or Nicaragua. No, so and that same model is being applied in the Eurasian Economic Union, which is in marked contrast to the institutional structure in the European Union, where Germany has more voting weight than, say, Ireland.
Right. What it really is a repudiation, fundamentally, of certain capitalist concepts of property and sovereignty. Because when you have in an economic organization or where you're doing economic integration, Grenada having an equal vote to that of Venezuela over potentially how to apply revenues from Venezuelan oil, you have an entirely different condition than one that would be based upon either the proprietary rights or the sovereign rights of it. It's like a common sovereignty and a common proprietary.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing, and it'll be interesting to see how this develops, is that of course, ALBA in itself runs directly contrary to the kind of free trade agreements that the United States was able to impose on countries under George W. Bush and under the leadership of Robert Zoellick, who is back then he was the U.S. Trade Representative, and Zoellick was the architect of essentially an exercise in mass economic bullying, whereby the United States deliberately exploited its economic power to extract the maximum concessions from small countries like those in Central America for the Central American Free Trade Agreement.
Right.
And what's happening now with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I don't know if you remember that, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership is this neoliberal free trade zone that the United States is trying to create between Asia and the Americas,
and without China. It's like it's the economic pivot to China.
Right, and of course that the what we were talking about earlier, the Pacific Alliance of Chile, Colombia, Mexico, and Peru. That's part of that.
Right, of course.
And so, but if you look at what's happening, there's a sense in which the rest of Latin America is turning its back on that, and developing, as we can see from the CELAC meeting in Jamaica about energy integration and energy security. And at the same time, you've got people like the president of South Korea, essentially, in a sense, kind of giving the cold shoulder also to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because they see more positive results for themselves by looking towards Russia, Central Asia, and China. So, and the United States representatives in that Trans-Pacific Partnership kind of plan must be extremely concerned about what that means for what they're going to be able to get as an end result of their initiative.
You know, and going back for a moment to the EEU. The Eurasian Economic Union. India, at this particular session, is looking to join as well. That came out. So we're talking about a powerhouse.
That was a very important announcement.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Another interesting development with the president of Uruguay suspending the meeting with Barack Obama.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how significant that is. The ostensible reason for suspending the visit, in by contrast with Dilma Rousseff's decision to suspend her visit to Washington. Yeah. Dilma Rousseff suspended her visit as a result of general outrage in Brazil, and on her part in particular, at U.S. spying of the Brazilian government and also members of Dilma Rousseff's family and herself as well. And but apparently the reason that Pepe Mujica, the president of Uruguay, decided to suspend his visit was the chaos resulting from the government shutdown.
That's right. Yep. That's what Telesur reported, that it had to do with the political situation, as a consequence of the shutdown.
Yeah, one has to remember that Uruguay is a tiny country, and I think its population is under 3 million.
It'll be growing soon, since you can go there and grow your own.
Yeah. So and of course, and one never knows from diplomat speak what the real reasons are. Brazil might have said to Dilma Rousseff, might have said to Pepe Mujica, look, do me a favor and don't go to Washington, because you'll be cutting the ground from under my feet. But you know, and you work out a reason why, but please don't go.
Right.
And I suspect that might well be the case. And it'll be interesting to see how the outrage that's currently playing out in Germany and France about U.S. spying on those countries' governments pans out. It seems to me that, and I find it hard to take seriously given the intimate relationship between those two countries' intelligence organizations and the CIA.
You never know what the personal will do to the political, because they were spying on her personal cell phone, and they're playing it up at least as if she's ticked off over that.
Okay.
All right, Tony, thank you very much. Tony Solo, our reporter in Managua, Nicaragua, reporting on things south of El Rio Grande.
And finally, it was 30 years ago today that Ronald Reagan sent 6,000 Special Forces troops to end an experiment in socialism on the tiny Caribbean island of Grenada.
In 1979, trouble came to Grenada. Maurice Bishop, a protege of Fidel Castro, staged a military coup and overthrew the government which had been elected under the Constitution left to the people by the British. He sought the help of Cuba in building an airport, which he claimed was for tourist trade, but which looked suspiciously suitable for military aircraft, including Soviet-built long-range bombers. The six sovereign countries and one remaining colony are joined together in what they call the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States. The six became increasingly alarmed as Bishop built an army greater than all of theirs combined. Obviously, it was not purely for defense. In this last year or so, Prime Minister Bishop gave indications that he might like better relations with the United States. He even made a trip to our country and met with senior officials at the White House and the State Department. Whether he was serious or not, we'll never know. On October 12th, a small group in his militia seized him and put him under arrest. They were, if anything, more radical and more devoted to Castro's Cuba than he had been. Several days later, a crowd of citizens appeared before Bishop's home, freed him, and escorted him toward the headquarters of the military council. They were fired upon. A number, including some children, were killed, and Bishop was seized. He and several members of his cabinet were subsequently executed, and a 24-hour shoot-to-kill curfew was put in effect. Grenada was without a government, its only authority exercised by a self-proclaimed band of military men. There were then about 1,000 of our citizens on Grenada, 800 of them students in St. George's University Medical School. Concerned that they'd be harmed or held as hostages, I ordered a flotilla of ships, then on its way to Lebanon with Marines, part of our regular rotation program, to circle south on a course that would put them somewhere in the vicinity of Grenada in case there should be a need to evacuate our people. Last weekend, I was awakened in the early morning hours and told that six members of the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States, joined by Jamaica and Barbados, had sent an urgent request that we join them in a military operation to restore order and democracy to Grenada. They were proposing this action under the terms of a treaty, a mutual assistance pact that existed among them. These small, peaceful nations needed our help. Three of them don't have armies at all, and the others have very limited forces. The legitimacy of their request, plus my own concern for our citizens, dictated my decision. I believe our government has a responsibility to go to the aid of its citizens if their right to life and liberty is threatened. The nightmare of our hostages in Iran must never be repeated. We knew we had little time and that complete secrecy was vital to ensure both the safety of the young men who would undertake this mission and the Americans they were about to rescue. The Joint Chiefs worked around the clock to come up with a plan. They had little intelligence information about conditions on the island. We had to assume that several hundred Cubans working on the airport could be military reserves. Well, as it turned out, the number was much larger, and they were a military force. 600 of them have been taken prisoner, and we have discovered a complete base with weapons and communications equipment, which makes it clear a Cuban occupation of the island had been planned. 2 hours ago, we released the first photos from Grenada. They included pictures of a warehouse of military equipment, one of three we've uncovered so far. This warehouse contained weapons and ammunition stacked almost to the ceiling, enough to supply thousands of terrorists. Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet-Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy. We got there just in time.
Bernard White is the program director of CPRMetro.org, the parent of CPR News. He is also the former program director of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. He was on the ground in Grenada at the time. He gave us an exclusive eyewitness account, which we will bring to you next Monday. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.